Welcome, everybody. I hope you're doing great. I want to ask you if there are questions that we haven't gotten to, things that you'd like to discuss just briefly, or even progress notes about your writing. I know we had a bye week last week, and I'm curious about where you are. I noticed in rereading the questions, the answers to the questions that you sent in, there are a couple that I wanted to address directly rather than sort of working it into the discussion or the narrative about creating your stories. But first, any progress notes or questions that we haven't gotten to that you'd like to briefly discuss before we launch into our topic today, the science of writing, really the neuroscience of writing? Anyone? Let me respond to two questions. One is, and I realize I haven't addressed this specifically, the notation is oftentimes I get these amazing ideas and sparks exactly at the time when I don't have a pen or paper or recorder handy. By the time I get my pen, they either fade away or morph or don't come with the same eloquence. Now, this is so understandable, and I think the best way you can plan is to always have something ready to write it down. I carry a little bitty moleskin journal, you know, the 2.5 inches by 3 or 4 inches, in my cargo pant pocket, wherever I am with a pen, whenever I'm sitting, you know, office, car, pickup, anywhere that I sit, there's a recorder, a digital recording device, and because that's, as I think I've covered, that's a basic way that I write, is to talk to someone or some group, so I always have something ready. So figure out what your best style is. If your best style is to see it manifest on the computer screen and see it visually as you type it, that's going to be a little tough because you're not going to always have an immediate access. So figure out maybe your next best and have some kind. I like the recording devices. I use an Olympus, $69 from Amazon, instead of like an iPhone or some of the other ones, because I can more easily, like when I'm driving, turn it on and off and not have to look at it or pay attention to it. It's just so much more convenient that way. But have something that you can jot down whatever you think about whenever you think about it. I mean, I have a pad where I watch TV late at night and the news in the morning. So it's there. Just in case. Just in case I have a decent idea, I'm going to capture that sucker right there. So I hope that's helpful. The other question is, how do I produce enough original material and perspectives to fill an entire book? Well, one way to think about it is the book may be the end point, but think about what you want to learn about, as we've talked before, what you want to engage and write about, and begin writing about it, and write about it in a way that's readable, that's interesting, that's engaging. You might want to think about doing a chunk that you can call a blog, so that when you do a blog, you have 300 words, basically, around one aspect of one idea. If your blog has a theme and an overarching storyline, then you can accumulate some things that you've done along the lines of what's going to be publishable. Let me give you an example. When I did a blog, I started a blog at the nudging of my publisher, McGraw-Hill, because I didn't really want to do a blog, but they insisted when a book of mine they published. So I did the blog, and I really got interested in doing it. I began to see all kind of things bloggable, and I did it on the subject of the book, money psychology and neuroeconomics, and I began to look at various things and accumulate more information. And when I got ready to do the sequel of that book, The Secret Language of Money, the blogs were almost 50% of the material that I used to adapt for the sequel. So it's a way, can I get a mute on the background noise? If you're moving around, if you're not muted, your microphone is picking up your movement. You're not hearing it. But even if you walk across the room with a headset, it's picking it up. So if you wouldn't mind muting. So think about the segments that you want to do. And remember, we talked about just do a segment at a time. If you decide to write 250 words a day, if you do that with consistency and stick to your plan, at the end of a year, you have a rough draft of 365 pages. So whatever it is, do what you love, because you won't have to get motivated. You'll just want to do it. Create a space and a time. Create a system. And look at what you want to write about. You're going to begin to see all kinds of things. The universe is going to conspire to present information, stories, research, books, things that will be of interest to you and be related to what you're writing about, because you've coded your radar. You're going to begin to see things like the yellow Jeep. You're going to see a bunch of yellow Jeeps once you begin to write about something. So I hope that makes sense, and I hope that's a decent enough answer at this point to those two questions, which are great questions and sort of ubiquitous ones almost, which is why I wanted to address them directly. Other comments, questions, or anything else to talk about before we move into the material? Anyone have anything to add or any other responses to those two questions about what you want to focus on and be sure you look at, that we look at and that you take away in the remaining two sessions? We're going to talk about the science of writing in this seminar, and in our last seminar next week, we'll talk about the business of writing, and that's going to include things like, what do you do once you've written a book? How do you sell it? How do you market it? How do you think about that from the beginning? One of the 48 Laws of Power is think it through all the way to the end. So when you begin writing a book, begin thinking about what you're going to do with it. Begin looking at building your platform, your list of people who are interested in what you're doing. And make a note of that. I still need a mute because I'm hearing some shuffling. If you wouldn't mind mute, unless you're about ready to talk, it will help my concentration at least. I wanted to just mention at next seminar, our final seminar, if you'd like to hang around and just discuss anything that we haven't discussed, or just have a discussion of any aspects of writing that you're interested in, let's plan to do that and to add maybe 10 or 15 minutes after the top of the hour just to have an open discussion about anything that we haven't talked about or something you want to go back and look at a little bit more. So plan to hang around, if you can, at the end of our final seminar next week. So final call, questions, comments? Okay, I'm going to move us to lecture mode, and we'll be off and running. Okay, we're going to talk about the science of writing and first talk about your comfort zone. To write and publish your first book, you'll have to leave your comfort zone. The comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process initially, but once established, it resists change. So think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. Any increase or decrease in room temperature signals an immediate adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and our brains both contribute to the maintenance of our comfort zone. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it, even when it's comfortable, even when it doesn't work. Think about any client you've worked with. Every one of your clients will have an experience of some kind of discomfort when they try something new and different, simply because that's the way their brains are wired, that's the way their mind software is engineered. And when you help them reframe that to the experience of excitement and challenge rather than anxiety, better head for cover, you help them move forward and engage more fully what they're doing and the changes they're making, and to help them monitor that so they can reframe it as being a signpost of going into new territory rather than my intuition tells me this is the wrong thing to do, or, you know, that this doesn't feel right, I'm going to end my anxiety. So a comfort zone can be a repeated role you play in a relationship, a repeated pattern like procrastinating about making a needed change. It can take various forms, for example, bargaining with yourself about seriously writing or really completing your book within a specific time frame. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. Remember that a habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. If someone gets more successful, they may feel vaguely uncomfortable, different. If you make more money than fits your self-image currently, it cues an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. Here's an example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners file bankruptcy within the first 5 years after their win. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. You can apply a system for change. Your mind can reframe, your brain can rewire. So one possibility here, make a habit of writing. Construct a schedule and be loyal to that schedule. Remember we talked before, you don't have to be motivated. You just need a plan, a specific plan, and stick to it. Now, let's talk a little bit more about frame. How you frame something can change the meaning. The meaning can change your mind, and your mind can change your brain. And we discussed just briefly before, our brain doesn't know the difference between excitement and anxiety. If you frame that particular activation as excitement and see it as a challenge to engage, it's a very different mindset, proceeding in a different way than if you read that and frame it as anxiety and something to avoid, you head the other direction. How you frame something determines the mindset and the meaning that you apply. So this structure of meaning is an inside job. You know, for example, if a traumatized combat veteran hears a car backfire, that immediately triggers a kindling in the amygdala that produces a startle response, instantly transporting to a different time and place and state of mind, a different state of mind that's like a time capsule. To the companion with this person with a different history, it's a background noise that may not even enter the conversation or even register. So each meaning and each frame is yours to construct. It's not there until you create it. Couple of simple examples. Well, I've got too much going on right now to find time to write. Reframed. I have too much going on right now not to create a specific schedule time to write. It's a way I take care of myself. Your response, your perception of an experience, and the meaning that you attribute to it, that's the bridge between the external event and the internal state. So, to determine any kind of meaning, you need a context to surround it. The frame determines and becomes your state of mind. Think about this in a slightly different way. The reticular activating system at the base of the brain decides what's allowed into consciousness out of all the information streaming into the brain. For example, right now, pay attention to your feet. Focus specifically on how your feet feel as you wiggle your toes, as you move your feet back and forth on the floor. Now, your feet have been there all along, but you attend to your reticular activating system to get feedback out of the millions of possible stimuli that you could attend to. It's focused attention. Now, broaden that just a little bit. You pay attention to whatever fits your life story, the framework you use. Now, let's look at how this can affect the story of your book. For example, part of your life story is your self-image. If somebody says something really nice about you that you don't believe, it either won't register or it'll be disavowed with some internal comment like, well, what are they trying to sell me, or what do they want? Natural filters include belief, self-image, goals. So how do you reframe, how do you reprogram your reticular activating system to let in what you want to achieve with your book, or to focus on what you want to? Here's the key to this entire discussion about framework. Your book outline is more than your blueprint and plan. It's your framework. When you start writing about something specific, examples of it begin to appear. It is, as I mentioned, as if the universe is conspiring to help you achieve your goal. Yellow Jeeps keep appearing. You can't get away from them. I first had a series of experiences in psychoanalysis that I've now had in mentor coaching as well, and I bet each of you have too. My patients at that time, who were therapists or analysts in training, would notice that as soon as they worked through an issue and came to terms with it, suddenly half a dozen of their own patients would bring up that issue that they had just dealt with themselves. Their patients had been unconsciously taking a number, patiently waiting until it was their turn, until their therapist or their analyst got their stuff sorted out so they could help them with it. Now, those of you who are professional coaches no doubt have noticed this and will notice this with your clients. They'll wait for you to get your arms around something so that you can then help them with it. Now, as authors, you'll notice it again, and it will pertain to what you're writing. You know, for example, suddenly in the first few months after the release of The Secret Language of Money, and that appeared just moments ago, as in the publisher made me do a blog, along with doing a licensed specialty certified training program for financial coaches and professionals, my clients began giving me illustrations. Their money stories were their center stage, needing to be coached. And that's what the law of attraction tells us. Whatever you focus on, you'll both notice and bring about. So here's a simple three-step combination to reframe and incorporate your new endeavor of writing. One, visualization. You can create powerful and stimulating internal images. It activates and focuses the reticular activating system of what to pay attention to. It cues your radar. Affirmations, the positive validation of being and doing what you want, are the software that support the story of the visualization, which is the rewiring of your brain. Two, change your behavior to exactly what you want. New behaviors, new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, those new pathways become just a bit more each deeply etched until finally, after enough repetition, they become a default mode. They become automatic. As soon as they're well-grooved, you'll have a new habit, an automatic behavior, as a default mode. Now, your future selves live in your present mind. If you clearly visualize that future self, you can then move ahead to actualize that vision. So, the science of a vision is that Visualization actually brings about physical changes in the brain. Your brain can't tell the difference between something that comes in through the optic nerve and something you create as a vision. When you replay the visualization, repeating the specific detail of the visualization, you program neural networks and neuronal pathways to etch that experience. You rewire your brain. When you program your unconscious, you're actually creating a future memory to live into that visualization. Now, here's the important aspect. You don't make the brain change permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. In other words, you have to revise the foundation of how and who you are, your identity, to incorporate what you're experiencing and visualizing as part of who you really are, part of who you authentically are. For example, this is most likely for most people why 95% of people who diet gain back their weight and then a little bit more. They don't reprogram their body image. Envision the experience of your completed book, not of getting there, but of being there. For example, of announcing its successful release, experiencing what it's like, seeing the entire experience of the book in places, in your home, in a bookstore, online. This is a way to incorporate your objective as part of your identity rather than it seeming to belong to somebody else or just being a wishful fantasy. We know that by simply picturing a danger, we can trigger the entire body responses of fight and flight. Now, while your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, your conscious mind can. And your conscious mind has to incorporate an evolving image, an evolving story, to assimilate that imagery and new self-concept as part of your story. Otherwise, unless you see it and metabolize it as part of your identity, it either won't register or it'll be extruded as noise or just be a behavior you do for a while until you return to the default mode. So there are three basic elements. One, repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision need to be renewed and repeated regularly or they'll be eliminated. Secondly, consciously incorporate this new vision into your ongoing story to be metabolized as part of yourself, as your identity, the bedrock of how and who you are. And third, throughout, specificity about the experience of having achieved the goal. Remember that the reason that we do what we do is because how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. And that's why I'm emphasizing, one of the reasons I'm emphasizing this so much here. Visualization crystallizes a possibility into an articulated idea. The experience itself changes the brain. A vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. Here's an illustration. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was in prison, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had two 99s. Everything else was in triple digits. So to preserve his sanity, when he was in a prison cell 7 days a week, he decided to visualize golf. He would imagine getting dressed, driving to his favorite golf course, getting out, smelling the flowers, warming up, hitting the ball, walking to the ball. He did this for 6.5 to 7 hours every day, 7 days a week, for 7 years of his captivity. When he was released from his captivity, on his first outing, he shot a 74. This is the power of a vision of mind over matters. let's talk about something that I think is really important for writers to really understand states of mind. We enter and exit states of mind fluidly and invisibly, like a precise passage of the baton between relay team members. Each of us has a set of different states of mind. For example, relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention, specific performance flow. A state of mind is a psychophysiological state. It's an internally organized software program that contains expectations, attitudes, meanings, and feelings. From an infinite sea of stimuli, the unique software package of each state of mind determines what data are relevant, and once those data become input, how processing occurs. It's analogous, roughly, to a software program on your computer. There are many different software programs. Each is consistent. Each has its own context, its own process, and content. So each mind-body state determines how and what we perceive, and then how we process information, and how we respond. A key element is our awareness of different states of mind in order to know what state works best for what purpose. For example, creative writing and editing. Different states of mind involve different parts of the brain. Brainstorming and completing a project also require different states of mind. The regulation of feeling and states of mind involves the understanding and mastery of access to each of your different states of mind. Here are some examples of how artists and authors enter a creative state to fit their specific work. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to entering the state of mind she needed to write her macabre literature. Dr. Samuel Johnson and the poet W.H. Auden maintained a continuous state of stimulation by constantly consuming tea as they wrote. Willa Cather read her Bible to set the right tone prior to her writing. George Sand went immediately from making love to writing. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite authors, Diane Ackerman, wrote and write, in Diane's case, soaking in a bathtub in a warm bubble bath with a pine plank across it to get that floaty, creative feeling. Coleridge used opium. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for a sail during an incredible storm and return immediately to recreate this experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to really house their evolving story. So the corresponding state of mind in the reader often matches that with the author. The author guides the reader to that state of mind through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of the imagery, the rhythm of feelings. Now, each of us has a continuum of states, a bunch of different states of mind, and usually some level of awareness what works best for which endeavor, even of how to enter and leave different states. We become more or less cognizant of the best state for a creative endeavor, the best one, say, for conceptual planning, or for whatever is needed, the alertness required for a business presentation to relaxation conducive to sleep. I've especially become appreciative of this in working with optimizing performance in artists and athletes and executives to really enter and sustain the performance flow for both practice and performance. And it is essential for optimizing a performance or a practice. So to be aware of and to regulate states of mind, think about this question. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Janis Joplin, they never learned the crucial success strategy of managing their states of mind, using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotion leads to significant compromise. So there are two primary ways to regulate a state of mind: physiology, which is how you use your body, and focus, what you focus on and how you focus. So this is, I think, something that can be regulated in specific ways. One thing I would refer you to for a broader discussion of this, on the very bottom of my homepage, MentorPath, there's a link you can click. There's a little some words you can click on. Master States of Mind. It's a webinar that's 30 to 35 minutes. You can click on that and have immediate access. Let me give you an example that you'll hear in that webinar that will give you an illustration of what we're talking about, and then refer you to that if you have time for some additional comment. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage. That was lowest in their division nationwide out of 217 teams. Now, during practice, Reed had his players, when they practice shooting free throws, develop a mantra. And that's simply a combination of a cue, a focus, and a physiology. Because focus and physiology are the two most powerful ways to regulate state of mind. The cue he suggested was to dribble the ball twice. At the time they were doing that, to use a physiology such as a deep breath in for relaxation, breathing out any tension, and to have a phrase that would focus their attention. He suggested relaxed and smooth, something that would fit that particular task. So in the 3 to 5 seconds that they did the two dribbles and the deep breath and the focus phrase, that was all they needed. It took no more time, but it was a system to do that. Now, additionally, during practice, he would suddenly blow the whistle, get them to go to the free shot line. If they made it, they got a break. If they didn't, they did 4 laps. And that simulated the performance condition. Because in a game, you don't get to take 30 free throws and count the best. You are fouled, and you're probably on tilt and tired, and you go to the line, and pressure's on, and you have to shoot 1 to 2 free throws. In 2 years, their team was number one nationwide in their entire division. This is simply a way to use a mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology, to regulate a state of mind, to get into a performance zone. When you do this enough, the cue alone will instantly create that state of mind for you. What I do before a presentation or before I get a call from a client or before we go live here is simply take about 3 to 5 seconds to put my index finger and thumb together on both hands, put them together to make a little infinity sign, and I am totally grounded and centered, 100% focused on what I'm about to do. Now, here's a sidebar. The focus phrase you want to fit what you want to do. In other words, if you're about to give a keynote, relaxed and powerful may be a good example. It's mine. But before you go to sleep, you don't want to be powerful. You want to relax and go to sleep. So be sure the phrase fits the task that you want. A simple example. As I work with pro golfers, for example, a focus phrase for a big booming drive is going to be different for a mid-iron that's going to require more focus and finesse than for a putting that will be relaxed and smooth. You don't want to be relaxed and smooth with a driver. You want to be relaxed. So think about fitting the task to what you're doing. So let's look at the application of what we're talking about of this performance flow. Even when you're riding, think about this as engaging in a state of mind that is conducive to what you're doing. Flow is a positive state that is getting in a particular state of mind in which you've done deliberate practice, you're developing skills, and you engage in practice and performance in that state. So here are some things, for example, that can get in the way, interfere with this creative process. Waiting until it's the right time. Waiting until you really have something to say. Waiting until you have enough money to justify the time. Telling yourself it's too late. Wondering what your family or friends may think. When you're in a performance flow, stopping to ask a question or stopping to think about it is a choke. We'll return to that. Or thinking that an appointment with yourself for creative time is an indulgence or a luxury. Schedule, protect, preserve the space for your creativity to live and to unfold. Create a system, a map, a structure to house that process, that experience. You establish the crucible for this creative force when you set aside time and honor it and provide an environment free of intrusions and distractions. So here's one possibility that kind of is an answer to one of the questions. In the beginning, it's not about where you sit, what paper you use, what you write about. It's about beginning. In the beginning, your job is to begin. A recommendation. Consider integrating your writing into other professional activities. We've already discussed how you'll begin to hear vignettes and illustrations to capture. Your clients will begin to bring you stories that will illustrate a point you want to make. Another strategy. Present what you're writing about. A blog, a white paper. For example, when I'm working on a book, I'll only accept speaking engagements that are in the flow of what I'm writing about so that when I'm working on a presentation, I'm also working on a chapter. Here's an exercise. One way to foster this creativity initially is to do what Julia Cameron in The Artist's Way describes as morning pages. Morning pages are three pages of longhand writing done first thing in the morning when you wake up, a total stream of consciousness. She emphasizes there's no right or wrong way to do this. Just write. Even if you can't think of anything to write, write anyhow. Don't edit. Don't judge. Just write. The morning pages are a primary tool for initiating or rediscovering your creativity. For those of you who stretch in the morning, this is your mind stretching. Do the morning pages. Now, one way to think, let me return for a minute to chokes or blocks, and specifically speak of blocks, writer's block. There were a couple of questions about that. Writer's block usually happens when the writer has difficulty entering a state of mind to create. The block, if you call it a block, that makes it a noun. That makes it sound as if it's an entity that's there working against you. It's like saying, my anxiety stopped me or my doubt paralyzed me. Without recognizing that you're the author of the anxiety, you're the author of that experience, not the subject of it, not the victim of it. So a block simply means that you need to enter a state of mind of creativity, and you're not there yet. As just one example, the most effective antidote to stage fright is getting grounded and centered. The most effective antidote to writer's block is getting grounded and centered. One way to initiate that process is to get grounded and centered. Another way may be to do morning pages. Centering keeps mind and body together in full focus. A brief relaxation and centering exercise can be a useful aid to this shift. A two-minute mindfulness meditation may be a way that if you began your scheduled writing stint with a two-minute mindfulness meditation, just focusing on your breathing, then that may be a way to get grounded and centered and the best preparation, the best bridge to this writing state. So a couple of things I want to cover before I pause for a discussion. One is a summary of the science of writing, and another is inverse wisdom for authors. So here's the summary of really the neuroscience of writing that we've covered, just perhaps in different words. Since old patterns are hardwired, consistency of focus on new experiences is what it takes to change this wiring. So concentrate on new behaviors, on possibilities rather than problems or obstacles in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't solve it. In other words, this is how people get stuck in therapy: to engage a problem, look at it ostensibly to create a better solution or a new ending, but just the engagement etches it further in your brain. Even Jung, the psychoanalyst, said some problems can't be solved, you just have to outlive them. He was a coach before his time. Create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize, the completed book, for example, to lay new mental maps. But do it segments at a time. What will you do this day for the time you've set aside? Regulate states of mind and manage emotions to really promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning. Left brain, right brain, intellectual and emotional, to put it all too simply. If you get diverted to an old feeling or behavior, immediately redirect focus to your new idea, to the new story, the process of the creative immersion in writing. Get recentered and redirected immediately as soon as you recognize it. Remember that the power is in the focus, and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. You won't get anywhere trying to figure out a problem. What we do in coaching is the choice architecture of this moment and what's next. What's the challenge, the opportunity, what's the next step? Focus aligns and directs energy and efforts. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Knowledge is inert until it's activated. Put it into behavior. A question that we might ask in coaching when someone says, well, you know, what I would really like to do or I like to be is blank. What would we see in observing your behavior together that would give us that notion or an indication that that's what you want? And if the answer is that you don't see it, what would be the first step to begin that behavior? when will you begin that first step? And the answer should be, as soon as I hang up the phone, he said nudgingly. So think about your new experience and evolving self, how new experience will require thinking of yourself, your identity, in a new way, no longer in the old story. Here's how that sounds. I'm an author. So, here's a final series of thoughts. Inverse wisdom for authors. So, these are the highlights of the introduction to Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual that I adapted for authors. So here's the backstory for this. I came home from college after my freshman year and announced to my mom that I decided to major in psychology. We talked. She was excited for me. Then she mentioned that she'd made an A in her college psychology course. I had no idea she'd even taken psych. I said, oh, I didn't know that. You must have really enjoyed it and studied a lot. She said, no, I just answered everything on the test the opposite of what I thought was right. Now, you'd have to know my mom to really appreciate that, but that is so consistent. Well, here's a list of things, 9 things, that are the inverse of conventional wisdom for authors in honor of my mom, who thought it was all opposite anyway. 1, burn your bridges. Make it impossible to go back to an old habit or way of being. If you decide to quit postponing the completion of your book, make it impossible in some way to go back to postponing it. Create an uncomfortable scenario if you should slip back. Focus on the present without the limiting habit. Reward yourself for proceeding and not going back. And even if you have writer's block, you don't get to go to the mall during your writing time or get on Amazon and order some stuff. 2, do the opposite of what you normally do when you're afraid, worried, anxious, uncomfortable, or stuck. The opposite. If you're uncomfortable with public speaking, we know avoidance is going to increase the fear, so do more of it. Embrace it. Join Toastmasters. You have to jump in the water because you can't learn to swim on paper. 3, obstacles reveal desires. Let me say that in a different way. Show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire. 2 sides of the same coin. Instead of figuring out a way to sidestep, overcome, or go around the obstacle, consider instead simply not creating it. And here's that concept put into coaching language. When you're ready to recognize that you create an obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Go back and listen to that on replay. It'll make even more sense then. 4, discomfort can be a sign of progress. Moving beyond your comfort zone is necessary, essential for progress. Comfortable is not a place you began. It's a place that you can arrive. Moving from a comfort zone is necessary in order to proceed. Comfortable and confident, in other words, are not prerequisites to proceeding. You proceed despite them, and then you get comfortable and confident. 5, lean into the unknown. If you wonder whether you can write a book and sell a book because you've never done it before, lean into the action of doing that. If you think you're too old for something, you'll be right. You can tiptoe through life very carefully and arrive safely at death. 6, don't believe every thought you have. I'll never be able to write a book. Thoughts lie a lot. They're kind of like my Uncle Ted, God rest his soul, or I'd have to use a different example. You don't have to believe every thought that crosses your mind. You're not even stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better. And here's what we know about self-directed neuroplasticity. Whenever you have a negative thought, a self-limiting thought, a thought of self-doubt, recognize it as an error message from your brain. Because your brain is wired to repeat something, and the things you've repeated, the negative thoughts that you've repeated, those ruminations of negativity, recognize it as soon as you do it. And the two other steps, after recognizing it, to call it an error message from your brain, because your brain is doing its job to repeat what it's hardwired, reframe to look at what the possibilities are now and next, going forward, and then refocus. So recognize, reframe, refocus. Self-directed neuroplasticity. That's going to be useful for a bunch of your clients in the future. Remember Vincent van Gogh's sage advice. If you hear a voice saying, "I'm not a painter," then by all means paint. That voice will be silenced. 7. You do not attract what you want. You create what you focus on. That's the neuroscience of our brains. Cue your radar for early recognition. Keep an eye open for yellow jeeps, stories, illustrations for your book, opportunities to talk about what you're writing about. A caveat, talk about your subject, not the book you're writing. Talking about writing your book can dissipate the energy of writing, I think. How many people do you know who have a book in them or have been working on my book for the last decade? 8. You only see what you believe. So I'll say that again. Some things have to be believed in order to be seen. And when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. This fact comes from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. In quantum mechanics, as well as the brain, the question you ask influences the outcome you have. A well-verified law is called the quantum Zeno effect. This is developed by the same neuropsychiatrist at UCLA, who's collaborated with me before, who really captured the whole essence of self-directed neuroplasticity. The quantum Zeno effect is the mental act of focused attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. When you do this consistently, your brain is rewired. Use this law to help you write your book. You'll begin to see more of what you need to write about, focused attention. And 9, believe in someone, and he or she will show you why you do. This would apply, I believe, to every client. That's why I only work with people in whom I believe, because I know that client is going to show both of us, why I believe in them. Neuroscience has demonstrated that authentic belief in someone activates the other person's brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. Now, that's huge. I want to say that again. Neuroscience has demonstrated that an authentic belief in someone activates that person's brain to create a state of mind that transcends their usual thinking and performance. State of mind is contagious, faster than the fastest virus. Now, that person can be you, the author. We're in discussion mode now, so if you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in any thoughts or questions or clarification. What are you taking away from what's the one thing that seems important to you that you're taking away from this seminar? One at a time, though. I welcome and invite your participation in a summary, just a sentence. What are you taking away?
This is Benita. I'll add something.
Thank you. I was getting lonely. Is this Benita T or Benita S?
Benita T.
T. Okay, go for it.
I like the neuroscience and how you can change your mind by what you focus on. So I like those tips that you gave for the authors, something really to wrap my mind around and try to start using those techniques.
Well, great. And I think that that brief webinar, I call it brief if it's under 35 minutes, on my website might be of help to you about really understanding even more and regulating states of mind. So I think that would be worthwhile if you have a chance to look at that. So thanks for that comment, and that's helpful. I'm glad, because I think that is, in fact, let me put this in a somewhat different context as coaches. There are a couple of studies recently, one from Scientific American Mind, one from Harvard Business Review, that found in research that the primary factor that determined success of executives was the regulation of states of mind and the self-awareness to do that. Now, that was the finding only because they looked at and did research on executives. I think that's true for everyone. To regulate states of mind and to have self-reflection to do that, it's especially important in performance. And any kind of peak performance, and I would call writing and the immersion in that creative process a performance flow. So I think it's especially important for you to do that. You'll see at the bottom of my signature line the newest program I have from the the Peak Performance Program, NeuroMentor Institute of Peak Performance. There's a whole training program about peak performance that, if you're ever interested in it, I'll be interested to, but you can just see some aspects of that, because that's what we're talking about really, is engaging in the performance flow of writing and how regulation of states of mind and sustaining that is a very important part of doing that. So thanks very much, Benita. Other thoughts or questions or responses? A major thing you're taking away?
Excuse me. Hi, this is Jen. You just mentioned
Great.
The Neuro Institute Peak Performance. Where do I find the material you just mentioned?
It's on the bottom of my signature line when I sent you an email.
Okay.
You just click on that link.
Okay. I need that a lot. Okay. In my tennis games. Thanks.
Ah, okay, yeah. Yeah, it was designed primarily for pro athletes and coaches, but the version that you see now is for mentor coaches. So, but I don't want to get sidetracked there. We have just another minute or two. What are you taking away? Are any questions about any aspect that maybe wasn't clear, you'd like just a little bit of elaboration about? Well, be thinking for next time about the questions and where you are. Really assess where you are in terms of the business of writing, of once you produce what you want to, once you create your book, and we'll talk about the 8 or 9 different variations of publication, different ways to publish a book, different ways that you can go from total self-publishing to traditional publishing with an agent and a national or international publisher. There are some variations, and we'll consider each one and look at the pros and cons of each and what may fit you best for that. So be thinking about that. Be thinking about the primary thing that you need to ask yourself on one end of that spectrum is the same question at the other end that an agent and a publisher will ask you: what's your platform? In other words, how many people do you have who are interested in what you have to say. How many followers do you have? How many ways of reaching these people? Social, business, media, various ways of doing that. A mailing list with emails that you have permission. Be thinking about that, how you want to develop and expand that in various ways to do that. And we'll talk about some how-tos of each of those. So have a great rest of the week. Take good care of yourselves. I look forward to picking up with you next Monday for our final seminar. And those of you who are interested and would like to hang around for discussion, we'll go over 10 or 15 minutes to be sure that all your questions are answered and we can just have a discussion. If there are any things you want to be sure we talk about, fire that off in an email to me. So thanks very much, and have a great week. Look forward to picking up right here. See you guys. Bye now.